This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living. I'm Meera Sivasodhi and it's Dr. Rajesh Singh's monthly show, consultant orthopedic surgeon. He's on the line with me. Welcome to the show, Dr. Rajesh. How are you today?
I'm very well, Meera. Thank you.
You know, Dr. Rajesh, when we did a quick Google search on the history of imaging, it turned up that, you know, only x-rays turned up as entries being the first form of medical imaging. And that's what we're going to be discussing today. Imaging in the anatomy then and now. But, you know, long before the x-ray, there were other methods to study and record the human anatomy as well, Dr. Rajesh. So you're going to help us take a trip back in time to understand what happened even before we had x-rays, are you?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, so our phone lines are open if you want to give us a call, if you want to WhatsApp or tweet us at BFM Radio. The phone number to call us is 7733 2900. You can also WhatsApp 7733 2900. Go for it, Dr. Rajesh. What actually happened, or how did doctors function before we had x-rays, and how did we document and analyze the human anatomy?
Okay, so let's start with sort of modern medicine. So maybe, Kriker, let's say World War I-ish. Okay, so probably 1900s onwards. The main way in which we sort of looked at anatomy was basically with our five senses. You know, we looked at people. We looked at people with our eyes. We looked at them while they were standing. We looked at them while they were moving. And then we examined people. So, you know, we felt structures underneath our fingers, and then we moved those structures and we felt the sensations that were underneath our fingers, and those gave us a sense of what was going on. And, you know, some medical conditions had a particular smell. You know, the idea of diabetes being somebody having sweet urine, so that was obviously the sense of taste. But, you know, extremely unlikely to go around tasting your orthopedic patients.
No way.
I kid you not, that was... Look, my daughter's studying diabetes in school, and I'm having to go through the fact that, you know, the history is that in even the 1800s, it was noticed that dogs were drawn, so when health and sanitation were poor, and, you know, urine and feces were just put out onto the street in open drains, dogs were drawn to the urine of certain individuals.
Right.
And the reason is because it is sweet, and they had diabetes. So...
hence, kencing manis, lah. That's probably where we got the name from.
Literally, it is. You know, kencing manis is probably the better term than diabetes mellitus.
Sorry, you were saying smell. Okay. Then you used your sense of, you know, your fingers. Okay. And
yeah. So we look at vision. So vision is probably the most important thing, and the appreciation of contours. Right. So this is probably the intersection where art and medicine come in. So I remember when I was a junior trainee, people could see things that I couldn't see because my eyes were not trained. And with time, as my eyes got trained, I could see things. And then, you know, when you point those things out to somebody, then they can see them. But otherwise, they just have the sense, like just today, I saw this gentleman who said, look, I've got this lump here on the front of my chest. And I examined him and I said, sir, that's not a lump. That's actually the contour of the bone that's on your chest. What's happened is the muscle has shrunk away. And because the muscle has shrunk away, you can then appreciate the fact that that's the contour of a normal bone.
Yeah.
But, you know, you'd have to know that that's what the contour of a normal bone at that location is like, and you have to appreciate the fact that it's a muscle that's sort of gone away. So the original imaging was basically using our senses and drawing what we saw. So that was the probably prototype of medical imaging, as it were. We had observations, and based on those observations, we make sketches and diagrams, and then we compare and we make measurements. So we take rulers and protractors, and we make measurements, and we document those things, then we measure them over a period of time. So that is probably the most rudimentary medical imaging. And the problem with that is that it wasn't very standardized. So depending on the vagaries of the human ability to measure things, those measurements were reasonably crude. Then came the advent of photography, and this is really where it became interesting, because you could then take a photograph of someone in a particular pose or posture or their particular anatomy, and you could then keep that and record that in two ways. You could either take it in a time series, which means that you recorded them at different points in time, or you could take it over different individuals and put those sort of individuals, different individuals together and compare a particular structure within an individual. So that sort of, the comparative anatomy is actually very interesting.
So if you just go back a little and, analyze how, doctors use their senses, right? The sense of smell, your vision, your touch. How would you document it? I mean, did anybody document it before the advent of photography, for an example?
Yeah, absolutely. Just pen and paper. So, you literally just draw. So you would have sort of schematics or schemas, and you would just sort of fill in the blanks or fill in the schema and say, these are the things that I have seen. And you can see that in a lot of the classic works. If you want to sort of take a popular literary reference, it would be the Sherlock Holmes, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle kind of character, right? Mm-hmm. So he would describe, the man was portly, with a slight stoop to the left, and there was a burn mark on his right finger, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it would really be sort of a descriptive narrative of what it was that you saw. And the purpose of that would be to say that, well, patients who have this general appearance then have that particular characteristic disorder.
Right. Do you tend to fall back to your senses first before you embark on any form of imaging?
Okay, look, I'm a classicist in that way. I love the classics. Mm-hmm. And I read the classics and I follow the classics for the reason that medicine is actually an empirical art. It evolved from human experience. If you look at, say, for example, chemistry. Now, chemistry is a little bit different because it evolved from human experience, but that human experience was to uncover fundamental laws. The same with physics, the same with mathematics. But in the study of medicine, human experience has uncovered some of the biological bases and processes. Absolutely true. But in terms of our daily interaction with patients, that's called clinical medicine. Now, that is actually completely based on experience. So that means 200 years ago, this is how they did it. And as a result of them doing it, these are the experiences that we've had. And since we've had those experiences modified by knowledge has given us this outcome. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very important for doctors, particularly doctors in training, to have some sort of classical reading to understand where things came from.
And do you do that? You teach. Do you get students to actually read?
I do. The challenge is the students today are not so much interested in the whole history because their life is already pretty full and complicated. Right? So Okay. There was no Facebook, Twitter, MSN. There were none of these distractions, which basically cause your attention to flip from one point to another point to another point to another point quickly. So if you wanted to study something, you had the opportunity to sit down and study and read it in depth. And what you could share was basically a journey. I mean, there's this guy called Oliver Sacks. Now, Oliver Sacks is a neurologist who wrote the book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Mm-hmm. Now, when you ask me about medical imaging and you talk about the brain, the first thing that comes to mind these days is something like an MRI scan or something fancy like that.
Yeah.
But what Oliver Sacks really did was he gave the power of narrative to make a drawing. So he would describe with absolute pinpoint accuracy the patient's experience of having a particular neurological deficit.
Wow.
Yeah. And one of the things which he sort of, I saw this interview with him, and he had a late onset blindness. Mm-hmm. So that means his brain was working, but the connection of the eye to the brain wasn't working well. And as a result, he had visual hallucinations. So being trained as a neurologist, he recognized what these hallucinations were, and he correctly described them. Okay, so, some of our listeners may say, well, that's not really medical imaging, is it? Because you're not taking a picture of something and you're not drawing something.
Yeah.
But actually, it is medical imaging because what he's doing is he's saying that one of the examples that he gave, for example, was that he would get patterns of a handkerchief and the handkerchief would flash in front of his eyes, like it was there, and he was compelled to remove it from the front of his eye or to pick it up. And the handkerchief always had a checked pattern with folded edges. So, you know, if you imagine drawing on a piece of paper a checked pattern with sort of folded edges away from you, that is actually what patients saw. And when he described this, he got a lot of feedback from people all over the world saying, well, I always thought that I was going mad and they were psychiatric delusions, when in actual fact they were hallucinations. But hallucinations that take on a specific identifiable form, which is the same for everybody with that medical disorder.
Right.
Okay. So that's the thing that's really cool, because what you can do is you can take a description of something which is relatively abstract and tie that description to a disorder or disease process.
But do you not think that doctors are already doing it? Probably subconsciously.
I think we are, but the difference, the problem with doing things subconsciously is that's called the expert. So in terms of knowledge and knowing, there are those who don't know, and then those who are learning, those are novices, and then there are the experts who know how they know, and then there are the unconscious experts who don't know how they know.
Right.
And the problem with being an unconscious expert is that it's a little bit frustrating to try and teach, because you can look at something and you go, I recognize this, but nobody else in the room does.
Yes.
And they say, well, how do you recognize it? You go, well, I've seen one before. Okay. Well, what are the characteristics of having seen one before? Okay. So I have an absolutely beautiful case in mind for this. I was doing some charity work in Indonesia with University Kebangsaan. So when I was there at University Kebangsaan, we had a charity mission where a bunch of us would travel over to Indonesia, to the poorest of the poor places, and we would spend a week or so running charitable sort of clinics and services in conjunction with the healthcare facilities which are already there. And I remember this one time we were in Kalimantan, and there was a doctor who was brought into the clinic with an elbow that looked like an earthworm. Now, I'm not sure if you sort of know what an earthworm looks like, but an earthworm basically has like this sort of a pointy bit, a big segment of her head, and then the rest of it.
Yep.
And she had a swelling of the elbow joint where, if you imagine her arm was a giant earthworm, that's exactly what it would look like.
Right.
Now, I had seen that picture before in a very old textbook of orthopedics showing that that was actually tuberculosis of the elbow.
Wow.
So, yeah, right. And because that was a classic appearance, that sort of, it's called a fusiform swelling, so that means that there's a thin part that leads to sort of a round, bulbous, elongated swelling, and then that leads to another thin part. And the characteristic is that the skin around the area is characteristically soft and hairless. You know, so kind of like a super duper, I can't tie it to basic science, but this is the description of what it looked like.
Right.
And I looked at it and I said, this is TB. And they all looked at me and they said, how do you know? I said, I've seen a picture of it in a book somewhere once before.
Right.
Right. So the idea there is that a medical atlas, meaning a series of pictures depicting the classic states of conditions, then become a form of medical imaging. And unfortunately, I suppose, these sort of atlases have lost their value in supplant to what we consider medical imaging now, which is an X-ray or a CT scan or an MRI.
Do you think it's really important, though?
I think it's fundamentally important, because I'll explain this lady's journey. I said to this lady, you have tuberculosis of the elbow. And they said, okay, well, we're not sure. So they organized for her to fly from Kalimantan to Jakarta to have an MRI scan of the elbow. And then based on the MRI scan of the elbow, they said, oh, this may be a tumor. Then they flew her to Sweden to a Swedish tumor surgeon who then did an operation for her and took out all the tissue and sent it to a lab that came back and said it was TB. So,
all that flying.
It's not just the flying. It's the fact that people miss the bigger picture.
Yeah.
Right? And they miss the bigger picture by looking too hard in too small a place. And all she needed was simple anti-tuberculosis treatment for a year and her elbow would have gotten better.
Yep.
So, you know, when you talk about medical imaging, I really wanted the show not to be about X-rays or CT scans or MRIs. I wanted the show to be about the pictures in medicine and how pictures in medicine, and the picture can be, in this case, of a disease state or a disease individual versus the sort of I would call that indirect imaging that we do these days.
Okay. So we'll come back in a short while because I know you are. You always talk about imaging technology and how we shouldn't be too dependent on it, especially when it comes to making clinical judgments. And that's exactly why we're sort of going back in time to figure out what happened even before we had X-rays and any form of imaging. And it's interesting that you've spoken about how you would fall back on your senses, and later on it comes with experience and how you form this series of pictures in your mind and how you diagnose, right? It sounds fascinating. And how you're saying now that medicine is a form of empirical art, I love that. We'll come back and find out more up next. If you have a question for Dr. Rajesh, give us a call. It's 7733 2900. You can WhatsApp 7733 2900. I apologize, that's a WhatsApp number. You can call us on WhatsApp as well, 0187898899. Coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living. I'm Mira Sivasodhi. Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon, on the line with me. We are discussing pictures in medicine. I've changed that title because it sounds more apt, Dr. Rajesh, based on what you've actually spoken about. We're going back a little in time and how imaging actually worked even before X-rays came about. Of course, now we've got CT scans and MRIs and all of that. But it's interesting how you have shed more light on how important it is to not just depend on imaging, but to go back to the basics, which is your senses, your five senses, your sense of smell, your vision, in your case, for orthopedics, the sense of touch. And it's interesting that you describe medicine as a form of empirical art. So just to come back, right? I mean, when you talk about pictures, it's static. But, Edward Muybridge, he did a series of time-lapse photographs, which he studied animal and human movement. And what's interesting is he did it in time-lapse, and it was important because he also needed to see the human body in motion. How important is that when it comes to diagnosis and figuring out what the problem really is?
Okay, look, the critical concept here is time. Because before this, you could take pictures. So let's make sure that we understand the concept. Before the ability to take a still image, three people had to be in the room to see the same thing at the same time. Once you could take a still image, a million people could see the same thing.
Yeah.
They didn't have to be in the room at the same time. Now, if you can take two images a time apart, that's adding another dimension to this understanding. So all that happened at the time was they took two images at a different time, but they took those images very quickly. So you could then see changes which occurred within a space of a few seconds, and that then allowed you to look at quick motion. So say, for example, in this particular instance, it was about race horses and to see whether whether the hooves were all ever off the ground. And, we accept that now. It's understood that when at some point in its gait, the hooves of a horse, all four hooves are off the ground. But in order to prove it, you couldn't see it with the human eye, or if you could see it with the human eye, you couldn't analyze it frame by frame by frame. You'd be sort of dependent on 10 people looking at the horse and going, well, I think it is and I think it isn't. So what happened here is they managed to make time-lapse photography, and they were able to capture a series of images very quickly. And because they had a series of images very quickly, you could then look at a particular movement and break it down into its component parts. So a really easy way of understanding is imagine if you're a discotheque and the lights are on and people are dancing and you just see sort of body parts flailing around everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And then the strobe effect comes on.
Yeah.
And when the strobe effect comes on, then you can actually see body segments moving and you can notice patterns of movement. So what the advent of time-based photography did, or even what the effect of a strobe is it basically breaks the movement down into smaller component parts. So our brain and eye isn't tricked by going from one part to the next part to the next part without pausing to think about it. The processing areas in the brain for things that move versus things that are static are actually fundamentally different. So if you have a ball coming at you, for example, the peripheral vision receptors are very, very active to look at that movement of that object. but your actual zoom and vision onto that object to say, well, let me describe the fine details of the object, are very hard to do.
But do you do movement, sort of non-static imaging? You don't really at the moment. It's all pretty much static, isn't it?
No. In ultrasound, that's exactly what we do, day in, day out, all day. So dynamic musculoskeletal ultrasound. So I've always banged on about the ultrasound.
Yes, I know.
It's not going to be any different.
You're the poster boy. You're the poster boy for ultrasound.
Because we can see so much more, right? So I had this lady today. She is Malaysian but lived in the U.S. for a long time and has come back now. And she came to me with an MRI and a CT scan and a complaint that her shoulder wasn't better, right? You know, she said, so I've seen 3 doctors in the U.S. and I've seen 2 doctors in Malaysia and I've had every scan imaginable and my shoulder's still not better. So I looked at the scans and I said, well, you know, the scans don't say very much. And she said, well, yes, obviously everybody's telling me everything's normal, but I can't lift my arm up over my head. So simple answer, let's just put the ultrasound on and see what happens in the area of pain while you're moving your hand over your head. And lo and behold, she has a little bone spur, which you can't appreciate clearly on any one plane, but when she rotates it, the bone spur scrapes up against the tendon and causes her pain.
Okay.
So what you've got there is you've got a dynamic image, but you've got a dynamic image in time. So this is the really exciting part now. If you take a series of dynamic images and you put a time series to them and you say that, well, this image was captured at this time, this image was captured at this time, this image was captured at this time, then you can say, well, at point A, the image should look like this. At point B, it should have transitioned to that. And at point C, it should have transitioned to that. It gets back to that stroboscopic effect again.
Yeah.
So that then allows you to make a lot of inferences about what's going on with the dynamic anatomy.
And this is ever so important when it comes to orthopedics, I can imagine.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's ever so important for anything that involves movement. So say, for example, for the heart, it's immensely important for the heart. You know, if you get someone on the show banging on about cardiac ultrasound, because it really is very, very important when you look at valve movement in the heart, for example. So when you look at anything, any soft tissue in the body that can move, vocal cords, you know, I've known some people who are doing some amazing ultrasound work with vocal cords. A lot of the head and neck guys, I'm helping some head and neck guys do some ultrasound of the head and neck as well, because you've got lots of tightly packed structures where, you know, when you speak, you open your mouth, you take a breath, all these structures move. So for them to be able to see structures in cross-sectional anatomy moving in real time, that's really where the sort of value proposition for ultrasound comes in.
So where does that leave your MRIs and CT scans and PET scans, for an example?
Okay, so PET scans are different. So PET scans are actually really, really amazing because they're functional scans, right? So you're looking at the function of something. And I would put ultrasound in as a functional scan as well.
Yes.
With regards to MRI and CT, you're looking at static anatomy. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with looking at static anatomy. But you need to understand that you are just looking at static anatomy. So you have to make you have to make 2 leaps. You have to say, well, okay, I understand that this is the static anatomy. Now I need to know how does it function dynamically in a time-based manner. And so this is important because if you lift your arm up to your side slowly, it's a different mechanic to if you lift your arm up to the side very quickly. So this idea of time-based in terms of imaging is, I would say, quite a novel idea. It's something that is relatively new in understanding because we now have the technology to be able to do it. So once upon a time, you needed to be able to take a picture quickly in order to, with the human eye, say, well, here you can see that all 4 hooves are off the ground. Now, not only can we take pictures quickly, I mean, my phone can take 120 frames per second.
Yep.
That's sort of how fast we can image. We now need software to be able to read those images and give us information that the naked eye can't see. And that's the next step. So the next step is to use computer processing power, which is ever increasing, to be able to say, since we can look at structures quickly, or we can look at structures in motion, and we look at structures in motion while they're moving quickly and we can look at them quickly, what extra information can we get by processing these images? And that's probably where the frontier is today in terms of imaging. And that imaging applies equally well to ultrasound, to MRI. You know, there's this sort of hybrid imaging now where you can actually marry the data from an ultrasound with an MRI.
Right, okay.
Yeah, and that's super-duper cool because each imaging modality has its strengths and each imaging modality has its limitations. So what we can do with computers now is we can actually say, here's an imaging modality that gives me a global view of things but can't give me information in movement. And here's another imaging modality that can't give me a global view of things but can give me information in movement.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens if I marry these two together to get the dynamic information which I need?
It will be fantastic, actually.
It already exists. It already exists. It's called fusion imaging. Fusion imaging. Yep, it's like fusion food, but food imaging.
Okay. We're talking about bringing static structures together with dynamic images, exactly, to have a better understanding of what's actually going on.
Correct. And you can put an overlay. So, because you see, what you're thinking about is, you're thinking about, say, for example, marrying a CT scan with an MRI. Well, why can't you marry a CT scan with an MRI with a video overlay of the person moving?
Hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
So you have an external as well as internal as to what's actually going on.
Correct. Because patients don't understand the internal, they understand the external.
Yep.
So when they say it hurts here, and I can show them in a sort of VR sense. So the Monash University has published quite a bit of work on virtual reality. So the anatomy department there has done quite a lot of work in terms of augmented reality and virtual reality. And the guys who are doing the virtual reality, I don't think is actually going to get us very far, but I think augmented reality is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Because there's an app on my iPad where I can actually have a virtual skeleton in front of me. And if I go in closer to it, it's like I'm sort of looking in closer to the part. If I move out, I move further away, I can sort of look up, look down. I can literally move around the skeleton and I can put structures on and I can put structures off. And, you know, having done this for the last 20 years, when I sort of use the app, I go, whoa, I never saw that before.
How far is all of this to what we refer to as artificial intelligence?
Okay, the thing about artificial intelligence is needed in creating the augment of reality. So that's why I really like the term augmented reality.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is reality, but reality with a plus one dimension, which is the augment. So the augmented reality, the artificial intelligence is necessary to create the construct for the augment of the reality.
Mm-hmm.
But it is still the fundamental human appreciation that tells us what does this mean. You know, I'm having this discussion about digital versus analog music with someone the other day.
Yep.
And how, you know, the fact that you have high sampling digital files, how much better they sound than analog files and how digital music is better than analog.
Yep.
And my response to that was, at the end of the day, unless you can plug the wire into your brain, all music is analog. Because it has to hit your eardrums.
Yes.
And the process of the sound hitting your eardrums is analog.
And your brain eventually after.
No, actually, the brain's pretty digital. I think that, you know, if you get down to it, just from my reading, you're gonna end up being surprised how digital the brain is. It's just that. It's like the megapixel story. When cameras first started, it was like a 0.1 megapixel, 0.2 megapixel, 0.5 megapixel, 1 megapixel. Now it's like, you know, 17 megapixels or something like that, right? Some ridiculous number. And I think the brain's a lot like that. I think that the brain's actually just lots of digital parts which are so densely packed that it looks seamless. But you can actually deconstruct it part by part by part. And if you say, well, I don't understand it, just go back to that strobe effect again. Something's moving. Without the strobe, it's linear. The minute the strobe comes on, it's digital.
You know, I love you for being a geek. Have I ever said that to you before, Dr. Rajesh? I mean, it's just you've got my brain going all over the place.
Yeah, but can't you see it? You know,
yes.
You can't see it, right? So, and that's the thing. So, the question is, what is analog and what is digital? And if you have to ask the question, what is analog and what is digital? The question is just, how fast is the strobe flashing?
Yep.
Because if the strobe is flashing fast enough, then your digital becomes your analog.
Yeah. Okay, got it. We'll come back, and I only have two more questions for you when we come back, which is, why should we know all of this? As a patient, I'm going to see the orthopedic surgeon, and why should I know all of this? How does that apply to me? How does that, you know, get me involved in this whole story that you've actually been telling us? And also how this translates to telemedicine, given today's new normal and how, you know, imaging is probably going to move online and, you know, how things can be a lot more efficient to a certain extent. What is the future of telemedicine when it comes to all of these developments? Coming up next after the market update on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Meera Sivasodhi. If you have just joined us, we have Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon, on the line for his monthly show. We are discussing pictures in medicine. We've gone back in time to understand how imaging was done well before x-rays actually came about. And you've spoken about how you, doctors, sort of depended on your sense of your senses. Then we moved on to drawings and illustrations and how photography came to be, how you've explained it's a series of pictures, which is like an atlas that you actually use to form a diagnosis, perhaps, and to figure out what's actually going on. You've spoken about how medicine is a form of empirical art. We've spoken about the static images and the dynamic images, such as ultrasound, and how we need both to make sense of this bigger story. You've spoken about analog and digital and how that comes together with this, if you imagine the strobe light. So it's all very, very put in a very layman's term so we all understand it. However, Dr. Rajesh, why should I know all of this? How does that make a big difference? Me as a patient, why should I know all of this?
Okay. Whose problem is it? My problem or your problem?
Mine.
Yeah, so the more information you have, the better informed you are about making a decision about your problem, and the better your ability to understand why we ask you to do certain things are. I'll give you a very, very simple example. So I'm treating a mother of a doctor who has knee pain, and I've examined her, I've treated her, I've corrected whatever her problems were. And she says, look, you know, I can do the exercises your physiotherapist tell me to do. I got no pain. I can do everything I'm asked, no pain. But when I do housework, got pain.
Okay.
So that is a fundamental lack of understanding in relation to what the biomechanics of the problem was. So, you know, I did have to go back to her and said, well, look, when we ask you to do these exercises, why do we ask you to do them? And she said, I don't know. My daughter says I have to do them, so I have to do them.
Yep.
All right. Whereas when she's doing housework, she's going back to her old habitual patterns of movement. And those old habitual patterns of movement are causing overload. The overload's causing degeneration. The degeneration's causing inflammation. And the inflammation's causing pain. So for her, that education was like an aha moment. I go, oh, okay, so you mean if I do my day-to-day things differently using what you've taught me, then I won't have the pain? I said, yes, it's kind of pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why patients have to know. And if I show somebody an MRI scan or an X-ray, you know, I love this. Patients will be sitting out in the, particularly when I was in public services, you know, if I'm walking down the corridors, patients are in the corridors holding the X-rays up to the light, discussing what the appearance of the X-ray is.
Okay.
And the X-ray is upside down, right? And they go, oh, you see that line there, or that line there look very bad. Oh, you see this line here look very good. But, you know, that's why the topic is pictures. What they're actually discussing is a picture, right? It's like any other picture. They're just discussing a picture because they have no fundamental understanding of what's underlying that picture or what does it mean. So if you give them a modality or method that they can sort of perceive and understand quickly, then their ability to understand their problem is very, very good. And once they can understand their problem, then they can comply or choose not to comply. But they're making an informed decision.
But But, you know, so what am I going to do? Sit in front of the orthopedic surgeon and he's done an MRI and he's giving me advice. And I'm saying, okay, so you've done this static imaging. What about the dynamic images? Are you not going to bother about that? I mean, are you not going to look at the status of my anatomy? I mean, are you doing functional scans, Dr. So-and-so?
Then they'll be saying, you listen to that bugger on radio, isn't it?
And the answer will be yes.
You should, whatever he tells you, it should correlate. You should have a fundamental understanding, right? That what is it I'm told correlates with what my problem is. You don't have to necessarily interrogate or cross-examine him on functional imaging, but you do have to walk away with a sense of understanding that based on what somebody's been able to look at on inside of me, I understand that this is how it causes my problem.
Okay, so think of the functional aspect as in where it is that you're having this problem and what do you actually do and it's causing it, and then ask those sort of questions as to how I can change that behavior in order to cater for physio and everything else that you've been doing. That's interesting.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's talk about telemedicine. Do you think all of this is going to change given the new normal? Do you think imaging is going to be ever so important going forward? I mean, you have said to a certain extent the very experienced doctor will subconsciously or unconsciously use the senses to sort of make diagnosis on top of the imaging. Without that, can you actually make a proper diagnosis?
The short answer is no. The long answer is augmented by artificial intelligence, we can probably double that success rate. Okay, so say for example, when you see somebody, and I mean, this is a very practical problem, so I have somebody in Singapore now who wants to have a consultation with me over the telephone, and we want to do a FaceTime call, and the practical problem that he has is that his problem requires for him to undress basically down to his underwear for me to be able to get him through to a series of functional movements like, you know, bend forward, bang backwards, bend to your side, turn your hips that way, turn your shoulders that way. And he lives alone because his wife's stuck in a different country and he's stuck in a different country. Mm-hmm. So who's he going to get to hold the camera to do that without getting into too much social trouble?
Tripod, no.
Yeah, but the thing is, it has to move. The camera has to move.
Oh, I see.
You see, because...
Why does the camera have to move?
Okay. So there's a guy called Ackland, and I'd highly encourage anybody who has a vague interest in anatomy even to sort of search the term Ackland's Atlas of Anatomy. What Ackland did was he's an anatomist, so he did dissections like all anatomists. But what he then did was he fixed the camera on a fixed point, and he rotated the camera around the object as opposed to rotating the object around the camera. And if you think about it, that's exactly how the human eye as a doctor perceives the patient.
Yeah.
So if you come in and you say, my shoulder hurts, I will stand up, look at you from the front, side, and back. That's standard orthopedic teaching. So what I've done is I've moved my eyeball around your body. That's how I've learned the subject. Maybe if I learned the subject by you moving around, it would have been different, but basically that's how we're taught in anatomy. So since I've moved my eyeball around the subject, if I'm going to examine somebody, even by telemedicine, I want them to be examined in the way that I understand to provide the examination. Because remember, medicine is an empirical art. And the empirical experience is how this is, the empirical evidence dictates that this is how examinations are done.
Right. Okay. Right? So you can't, it's not as simple as that then.
No, it isn't. So this is the thing people fail to understand about telemedicine. That's why when you summarize that, doctors function with their senses first. Well, what do you get with telemedicine? You've only got one sense, which is actually two senses, which is your sense of sight and your sense of sound. But both of which are somewhat muted because of the restrictions of depth perception, for example. You know, you can't perceive depth on a flat screen.
Interesting. Hey, I'm just curious, Dr. Rajesh. It might sound like a silly question, but we have time lapse as a function on our phones. Can that be of any use?
It can, but then it isn't in a medically practical sense.
Okay. It's not going to give you the sort of the sort of images that you need to make a diagnosis.
The time-lapse function is not in the time frame that I need it to be in.
Okay. Would you have a message for us on pictures in medicine?
Okay. Can I read you a short quote by John Chanley? John Chanley is widely considered to be the father of modern orthopedics.
Okay.
Okay. So it's about 10 lines long. It says, this is from a preface to a book that he wrote. There is a tendency to imagine that serious research nowadays can only come out of a laboratory and that contributions from the pure act of thinking on clinical facts ended with the great clinicians of the past. The old clinicians had their faculties of observation by sight and touch heightened by the absence of x-rays and laboratory tests. But though the clinical acumen of the old observers was apparently greater than ours, it was frequently offset by strains of credulity, in which apparent in a different form amongst clinicians today. In the past, the clinician philosopher was credulous because he was the victim of inherited beliefs. But today, our credulity lies in the accuracy with which we attribute to our special research tools such as the electron microscope. We must not forget that sight and touch together make the greatest clinical faculty of all, namely, common sense.
Fantastic. Very well said, Dr. Rajesh. Thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome, Mira. Thank you for the opportunity.
Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon, talking to us about imaging in anatomy then and now on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.